WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The subprime mortgage industry that has caused such volatility in the stock market and the hedge funds that have also contributed have something in common. They have exploited loopholes in what remains of financial regulation, writes my guest Robert Kuttner. Robert Kuttner is the author of the new book, The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Kuttner is an economics writer. He co-founded and co-edits the American Prospect magazine and is a senior fellow at the liberal think tank Demos. Robert Kuttner, welcome to Fresh Air. You describe the stock market as having turned into a casino. The stock market has always been something of a gamble. Give us one or two reasons why you think it's become more of a gamble than ever for investors.
Well, it's more than just the stock market. It's the entire financial economy, meaning banks as well as shares in stocks as well as bonds. There are more ways to invest money speculatively. There are more ways for banks to create bonds and other kinds of exotic instruments that regulators don't understand, that investors really don't understand. I suppose Exhibit A is the subprime collapse, where loans were made to people whose outstanding characteristic was that they did not qualify for loans. They were not even asked to provide income verification. But because blue chip banks turned those loans into securities, bonds, and the bonds were blessed by bond rating agencies, incredibly enough, with AAA ratings, and some pension fund or some hedge fund or, as it turns out, some affiliate of the bank could be persuaded to buy those bonds, everybody thought this was just a great way to make high returns. That's a gamble because nobody really knew what this stuff was worth until someone had to sell it, and it turns out it's not worth very much. That's a casino. That's not like investing in something that's transparent, where you have some reasonable expectation of being paid back. And what's true of subprime is true of more and more of the financial economy.
Now, you blame some of this on deregulation. What are some of the regulations that no longer exist that you think might have prevented the crisis that we're in?
I blame virtually all of it on deregulation because if you go back to the 1920s, you can find three basic abuses that characterized almost all of the excesses of that decade. Number one, a lack of transparency. There were misrepresentations of what balance sheets and stocks and bonds were actually worth, all kinds of opaque kinds of securities. There wasn't an SEC in that era, Securities and Exchange Commission, so there were no mandatory disclosures. You just had to trust the bank or the brokerage. Secondly, there was much too much leverage, much too much margin, much too much borrowing in order to speculate. Thirdly, there were conflicts of interest where insiders were peddling all kinds of paper that turned out to be junk and not disclosing the fact that they were on both sides of the deal and they were extracting fees. Now, in the 1930s, Congress passed all kinds of laws requiring disclosures, reducing the temptation to engage in conflicts of interest. Probably the most interesting for our purposes was the Glass-Steagall Act, which said that you either have to be a commercial bank or brokerage that underwrites bonds and sells securities. But you couldn't be both, because if you were both, you would be in a conflict of interest and you would be tempted to take dubious loans and package them as bonds and sell them off to the unsuspecting investor. Well, of course, this is exactly what Citigroup has done. And Robert Rubin, when he was Secretary of the Treasury, was one of the principal architects of the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which finally occurred in 1999. And then not long afterwards, he goes to work for Citigroup as a very senior executive. At the time, the legislation repealing Glass-Steagall was jokingly referred to as the Citigroup Enabling Act. So I think all of these difficulties that the financial markets have gotten into are the fruit of too much speculation with borrowed money, which in turn is the result of too much deregulation.
Now, you want more regulation of the financial world, but what about the Fed? It's a regulator. It regulates interest rates, but you describe the Fed as having become an enabler.
Well, the Fed is a very interesting case in point. One of the things I talk about in the book is all of the time since the late 1970s that the Fed has come in and bailed out large financial institutions that had gotten into trouble for making bad bets. So in the late 1970s and early 1980s, the big money center banks in New York made bad bets on third world loans. The Fed comes in and cheapens money and bends the rules so that they don't have to carry these underwater loans on their books at their reduced value, because otherwise several banks would have been technically insolvent. Interestingly enough, during the 1990s, Alan Greenspan gave that famous speech where he expressed worry about irrational exuberance because he thought the stock market had been bid up to unsustainable levels. That was in 1996. Stock market still had 4 years to go before it crashed. But because so many financial institutions were in trouble, Greenspan had to keep interest rates lower than he thought prudent in order to bail out these institutions. Now, my point is that the Fed has more than one weapon in its arsenal. One weapon is lowering interest rates. The other weapon is regulation. If you're not going to be in the situation where you have to bail these guys out on the back end, it's much wiser policy to regulate them on the front end.
What kind of regulation would the Fed be capable of outside of controlling interest rates?
The Fed has all kinds of powers that in the Greenspan era it was loath to use, because Greenspan really believed that markets were self-correcting, except, of course, when the Fed had to come in and bail them out. So one example precisely on point here, in 1994, there had been some scandals involving predatory lenders. In a rare bout of regulation, Congress passed a law, the Home Ownership Equity Protection Act, that gave the Fed the authority to regulate lending standards for mortgage companies that were otherwise not federally regulated. And Greenspan simply refused to issue the regulations. And by 1995, the Republicans had taken back Congress. Congress was not in a mood to insist that the Fed carry out the law. And so we actually had more than a decade of warning that this was a problem that was brewing, that was only getting worse. The regulations were on the books. The Fed refused to enforce them.
So what do you think the Fed should have done?
Oh, the Fed should have issued rules under the 1994 legislation requiring anybody who was originating a mortgage loan and trading that loan in what's called the secondary mortgage market to have normal, prudent underwriting standards, not to make loans to people who had no reasonable prospect of paying back the loans.
You know, when you were running through some of the reasons that you see behind the economic crisis, the financial crisis that we're in now, you mentioned conflict of interest. What are some of the conflicts of interest that have contributed to the subprime crisis and the other crises related to that?
Well, people sometimes think that these subprime lenders are one cut above your local mafia lender. In fact, they are literally put in business by some of the bluest chip names on Wall Street. Citigroup and some of the others underwrite these subprime lenders and then buy the paper from them and then turn it into bonds. So if you are, let's say, Citigroup, and you have a relationship with a subprime lender and you are extracting fees for transforming the nature of the loan into a bond, and you have some reason to suspect that that bond might never be paid off because the circumstances under which the loan was originated are very dubious, and yet you sell that bond to your customers and extract a very nice fee and a very nice markup, that's a conflict of interest. At the very least, it should be subject to greater regulatory scrutiny.
You've singled out Citibank as being representative of a financial institution that had conflicts of interest inside that led to larger problems for the economy. Are there other financial institutions that you'd put in that same category?
Yes, of course. And I keep mentioning Citi because it's one of the biggest, and also because it had by far the biggest exposure to subprime through these so-called special investment vehicles. But other banks played these same kinds of games with off-balance sheet entities like Wachovia, although at a lower level. And of course, we've seen what happened with Merrill Lynch losing a ton of money through this. So it's hardly a question of just one institution. We have a whole system where too much financial engineering has been tolerated by the regulators at the expense of the rest of the economy.
Recently, Citigroup has had financial problems. Merrill Lynch has had enormous problems. Morgan Stanley's having problems. Wouldn't it be like a terrible thing for the nation's economy for these banks, for these investment banks, to really falter? I mean, that would hurt so many people. So what's to be done?
Well, I think I am not the dog in the manger here. It gives me no satisfaction to see these problems. My point is, let's learn some lessons from this. The Fed has to step in and help. We may reach a point where some public capital has to be put into this, as was done in the savings and loan bailout, because to do nothing, just to prove the point that markets are not self-regulating after all, would be churlish and would cause much wider damage. The only reason that these kinds of credit panics don't lead to great depressions the way they did in 1929 and in 1907 and in earlier financial panics is that we have a central bank. The central bank's a lot smarter. It's a lot more interventionist, and the central bank, the Fed, is not going to let the whole economy go down the drain. But if you're going to do that, let's learn some lessons for next time. Let's take away temptation. Let's restore a degree of regulation so that the insiders don't play these speculative games with borrowed money and put the whole economy at risk. And by the way, having the Fed intervene by cheapening money is not costless. It puts the dollar at greater risk. It creates greater risk of inflation. You can't not do it. The Fed can't stand by and run the risk that a credit panic is going to lead to a depression. But bailing out these bad bets that were done so that a few insiders could get very rich is not without costs.
My guest is economics writer Robert Kuttner. His new book is called The Squandering of America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Kuttner. His new book is called The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Our Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. He's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and a senior fellow at Demos, which is a liberal think tank. One of the key points in your book is this. You say the increasing financial insecurity and inequality for ordinary people and the increasing risk of collapse now afflicting financial markets are two sides of the same coin. And that coin is the willful dismantling of managed capitalism. What do you mean?
There was a period after the Great Depression and World War II when events proved that unregulated capitalism didn't work very well. Laissez-faire was a practical failure. And then along came World War II, which, of course, was a victory not just for the Allies over the Nazis, but it was a victory for the success of government, showing that government could do great things. And so there was a period of about 30 years where we had a managed form of capitalism, what Paul Samuelson, the economist, called a mixed economy, where you relied on markets for entrepreneurship, but you relied on government for regulation, you relied on government for social investments that markets didn't provide. And that was a golden era. The economy grew at an average rate of 3.8% a year, and that prosperity was very widely shared, and Americans who were poor in the Depression became part of the great post-war middle class. Beginning in the 70s, there was a reversal. We had a difficult few years, mainly because of the OPEC oil shock, which created inflation and recession. And coming out of that, the fashion changed, the politics changed. And over the course of almost three decades, the idea that you needed a regulated economy, you needed a tax and spend economy where you had progressive taxation and government supplemented what the private market couldn't do, that fell into disfavor. And business liked that because business never likes regulation. Business never likes taxation. And by the 1980s, both parties, I'm sorry to say, are outdoing each other to deregulate, to cut taxes on wealthy people, and to limit government's expenditure on social insurance. And the power of trade unions to offset the power of business is weakened. So the whole balance in the economy gets out of kilter because we dismantle these institutions of a managed form of capitalism. And that's bad for ordinary people. It's bad for the stability of financial markets. And it's bad for the system as a whole.
Now, I want to get back to personal investment. You know, a lot of people think of themselves as not invested in the market, and yet their retirement funds are in mutual funds in the market. And then a lot of investors do invest in mutual funds thinking that they're a safer investment than just thinking you're smart enough to pick individual stocks and expect them to do well. And people are often encouraged to invest in mutual funds for that reason. But in your book, you describe the mutual fund industry as a scandal. Why?
Well, what people don't realize is the huge middleman fees that mutual funds take. And here I want to plug another book, John Bogle's wonderful book. He was the head of Vanguard, one of the first and biggest mutual fund companies. And Bogle calculates that if people just picked a random list of stocks, and the list was large enough so that you would have the average return of the stock market as a whole, you'd be about 40% better off than by buying a mutual fund, an average mutual fund, because of the fees and the other forms of middleman income are so astronomical. Now, it's true that diversification makes sense. It doesn't make sense even if you think you're absolutely certain that Google or some other favorite individual stock is going to go to the moon, but it doesn't make sense to have all your eggs in one basket, as the old saying goes, so you want a diversified portfolio. But mutual funds are not the only way to get a diversified portfolio. You can just buy an index fund where you're simply buying a fund that's representative of all of the stocks on the stock exchange, and the fees are much, much lower. It's a second-order scandal. It's a kind of ongoing low-level scandal, but it's an example of how markets are really rigged in favor of insiders at the expense of the average investor.
My guest is economics writer Robert Kuttner. His new book is called The Squandering of America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is economics writer Robert Kuttner. His new book is called The Squandering of America, How the Failure of Politics Undermines Our Prosperity. Now, a lot of the financial problems that we're seeing right now have to do with hedge funds. And you describe hedge funds as a result of a loophole in the Investment Company Act of 1940, an act, of course, I know nothing about. So what's the loophole and how are hedge funds created?
Okay. Back in the day when Congress was regulating financial markets and requiring all kinds of disclosures, Congress required that if you were going to set up a mutual fund, you had to make a variety of disclosures to protect the investor and to protect the system. There was a small exemption created whereby if you had essentially an investment club or a private investment fund where you were not selling shares to the public, you didn't have to register with the SEC and you didn't have to make disclosures. And for a long time, from 40 or 50 years after that act was passed, hedge funds were very small players. They were niche players that made a few people very rich, that could engage in all kinds of exotic gambles. And if they were very smart, like George Soros, they could make a lot of money for themselves and for their investors. And then in the 90s, hedge funds just exploded. And one of the reasons they exploded was that people realized that, hey, we don't have to make any disclosures. And initially, they were selling only to very rich people, which is what the law required. But then there were loopholes on top of loopholes in that you could invest in what was called a fund of funds, where a fund invested in lots of different hedge funds. And then the requirement that you had to be rich in order to invest in it was waived. Or your pension fund could invest in a hedge fund. You were talking before about how people were at risk in ways they didn't even realize. If your pension fund is invested in a hedge fund, your pension could be at risk. And the problem is that everybody can't be above average. And so you read that X hedge fund made 30% last year, and you say, wow, that's fantastic. I don't mind paying the huge commissions because I want that 30% return. But what you don't read is the average hedge fund no longer even beat the market average. And so hedge funds are another accident waiting to happen. We haven't had the crash of a big hedge fund since 1997, but I think that's only a matter of time as well.
In what sense do you think that hedge funds are an accident waiting to happen?
There's too much money invested in very exotic gambles that is beyond the purview of regulators or even of the investors who put their money into hedge funds. Often, different hedge funds make the same kinds of bets. That's what happened in the late 1990s, and I think they ought to be more tightly regulated. The UK, which is the home of a lot of European-based hedge funds and private equity companies, has a much tougher system of regulation than we do. We basically don't regulate hedge funds. The UK requires the biggest hedge funds to disclose their investment strategies to the regulator, to disclose their holdings, so that if you get into the kind of accident that we had with one of the big hedge funds 10 years ago, the regulator can see whether these exposures are affecting other hedge funds. And I was actually expecting that that there'd be a hedge fund crisis before there was a crisis in subprime. But any one of these is an accident waiting to happen.
But I thought the subprime created a hedge fund crisis. I thought the hedge fund crisis kind of happened already.
Oh, no. Some hedge funds were overinvested in bonds backed by subprime mortgages. But there's a lot of other dubious paper out there and a lot of other gambles made by hedge funds. And there is at least another shoe left to drop.
Do you think we're heading for a recession?
Oh, I'm convinced of it. I mean, you can't have these kinds of hits to financial markets and not have impacts on the rest of the economy. And this is happening simultaneously with a weakened dollar, which means that anything you import is likely to be more expensive. Or if you're thinking of traveling abroad, that's likely to be more expensive. Or if you're staying in a hotel in New York, all the room rates have been bid up because so many Europeans are here taking advantage of the bargain basement prices. And then, of course, oil is denominated in dollars. I'm not sure how much longer that's going to continue, but for the moment, oil is priced in dollars. And if the dollar is worth less, the oil-producing companies just raise the price of oil. So we have oil hitting something like $100 a barrel. Everybody pays for that at the pump. Well, you combine all these three things, cheaper dollar, higher-priced oil, weaker financial institutions, and then on top of that, for the first time since the Great Depression, you have a long-term decline in housing prices. I don't know how you avoid a recession when all of those things are happening simultaneously.
You describe your book as being about the connection between a precarious economy and diminished politics. We've talked about regulation. What are the other ways that you think diminished politics have affected the precarious economy?
Well, here's the vicious circle. Democrats, who used to be the party of the mixed economy, used to be the party of tax and spend, Democrats have been complicitous in this dismantling of the mixed economy. They have been part of this effort to deregulate. And Democrats have become very reliant on campaign finance by Wall Street and by other very wealthy people. And as a consequence, it's less persuasive when Democrats try to run as champions of ordinary people because they're not offering ordinary people all that much. So the political scientist Walter Dean Burnham, someone I admire very much, has a wonderful phrase he uses called the politics of excluded alternatives. I think there's a whole alternative path for the American economy that involves better regulation of Wall Street, better social investment so that people don't have to be afraid of losing their health insurance or losing their pension if they change jobs or are laid off. And the problem is, at the level of presidential politics, few candidates seem to be offering this. I think the good news, from my point of view anyway, is that if you look at the 2006 midterm, all of the Democrats who took back Republican seats in the Senate, most of the Democrats who took back Republican seats in the House, ran as economic progressives and did win by offering something to ordinary people.
You've given us a lot of not very good news during the course of this interview. Is there a positive note that you could find someplace to end on?
Oh, I can think of two very big positive notes. Number one, we're not going to have another Great Depression. And number two, we're going to learn some lessons from this. And if the Democrats in particular have their wits about them, it gives them a basis for proposing a very different kind of politics, a very different kind of way of organizing the economy. We've had now a 30-year field test of the proposition that financial markets can regulate themselves. That proposition has been proven false, and that opens the door to a very different way of managing the economy, which would be better for ordinary people. So I think another world is possible. We've had a very different brand of economy in the past, and I hope we're going to have a different one in the future.
Well, Robert Kuttner, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Robert Kuttner is the author of the new book, The Squandering of America. He's the co-founder of the American Prospect magazine and a senior fellow at the think tank Demos. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org.